Vita Voices and Views is brought to you by Vita, Women in the Literary Arts, with host and executive producer Melissa Studdard and executive producer digital media R.J. Jeffries.
A Renaissance artist of unmistakable signature, Patricia Smith has been called a testament to the power of words to change lives. She has authored and edited 6 critically acknowledged volumes of poetry, a children's book, a crime fiction anthology, and a companion volume to the groundbreaking PBS history series, Africans in America. Her numerous accolades include the Rebecca Bobbitt Prize from the Library of Congress, the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize from the Academy of American Poets, and the Phyllis Wheatley Award in Poetry. As well, she is recognized as one of the world's most formidable performers and is a 4-time national individual champion of the Poetry Slam. She was featured in the film Slam Nation and appeared on the HBO series Deaf Poetry Jam. Additionally, her works have been transformed into award-winning films and plays, and her vocals have been featured on jazz CDs and radio commercials. An accomplished and sought-after instructor of poetry, performance, and creative writing, Patricia often appears at creative conferences and residencies and is a Cave Canem faculty member, a professor of English at CUNY College of Staten Island, and a faculty member of the Sierra Nevada MFA program.
Hi, Patricia. Welcome to Vita Voices and Views.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks. Glad to be here.
It's wonderful to see you. I wanted to start by congratulating you because I read that you recently got granted full tenure.
I did, actually. I still feel the same.
Yeah, do you?
I thought I was going to wake up and there'd be a little tiara next to my bed or something, but it's good. It's good because the teaching was something that came a little bit later for me. So it's really good to be recognized that way.
The thing is, the tiara just hasn't arrived yet. I had it shipped yesterday.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So actually, I wanted to start in kind of an unusual place with you. I know that a lot of people know you for your poetry, which is wonderful. But I fell in love with you first through this children's book. Oh, I thought it was behind me. It's actually over here. Janna and the Kings. So I wanted to ask you about that. And I read that it was inspired by your afternoons at the barbershop with your father.
Yeah. My dad, the barbershop was kind of a focal point of our neighborhood. If you stayed there long enough, pretty much everybody from the neighborhood would come through. And it was so different. My dad would take me there, whether or not he needed a haircut. And we would just kind of sit there. The guys taught me how to play checkers. They let me ride around in the big chair. They'd spin me around the chair. I'd sit there and I'd talk about what I was doing in school. They'd tell me about their kids and their grandkids. So it was kind of a weekend place to be. And I remember it fondly. I actually wrote some poems later on that were the voice of a barber that I remembered. And so it was really important to me in my upbringing. I was an only child, too. So that camaraderie that I felt there with my dad and seeing men in really easy friendships. You know, I think that stuck with me for a long time, too. So I always wanted to do something about my dad in the barbershop and always thought about writing a kid's book. But kids' books are incredibly hard. You get an idea, you go to Barnes & Noble, you look around, everything's been done. Every single thing. It's not as easy as you think. So I usually will get motivated in a really strange way. And I had torn out a little ad for a contest. And it was a contest for new children's book, a new writer, someone who hadn't done it before, a press that I really liked. And I kept moving the little piece of paper around on my desk. And I work really well when I'm pressured. So I saw the thing. There was like a day left. And I said, okay, let's see if I can write something about my dad. And I didn't think I would win, but I thought maybe they'll be nice enough to give me some feedback and I can redo the story and resubmit it somewhere. But normally when I'm not overthinking things, that's when they come easiest to me. And so I wrote that story out, didn't make it about my dad, but made it about a little girl who was somewhat like me and her grandfather, and the world that was built up for her around the barbershop, and whether or not she felt she was still part of that world after her grandfather had died.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story. And I like what you said about the men and their gentle connections, because one of the things I loved about it was how just gentle the men were in the story and how welcoming they were to her. It's really lovely. And I have to ask, were you Princess Sugarlump?
Yeah, it was one of the things my dad called. The strangest name my father had for me when I was a kid was Meathead.
Ah!
He'd say, hey, Meathead, you know. And it was the sweetest thing until I told someone else, and they said, your father called you Meathead? Really? Like, where did that? But to me, it sounds wonderful. I love it.
Of course. And you're like, no, it's a term of endearment. It's affection.
Yeah.
Well, see, so you were Princess Sugar Lump, so you should have had your tiara long ago. That's really nice. So I also remember reading that, and I talked to you a little bit about it in LA, that you draw a lot of inspiration from children's books as well. And I would love to hear a little more about that too.
Sure. The thing about children's books is they remind me how pliable the language is. I mean, as we get older, we learn this rule and that rule, and then we learn specific structural rules for poetry and anything else we write. And we forget that I think we first started working with words because we could play with them.
Right.
Yeah, and children's authors tend to remember that, and you'll see very inventive language. You'll see words that are nouns that should be verbs and otherwise, you know. They just remind me that I haven't grown out of that, that I can still do that. And it's still something that very much has a place in poetry. If you can just remember and revel in that joy, as opposed to being unlearning all those things and think that that makes you more mature in your art, when actually it doesn't.
No. Well, that's great. And I think, you know, with you, in addition to drawing inspiration from children, I understand that you also inspire children, and you go around to schools and middle schools. And
I try to. I just remember when I was in, you know, second, third, fourth grade, there would be a poem in our textbook, and it would always be Robert Frost in the Woods. And that would be our poetry unit. We do that, and then the teacher would say, and that's it for poetry. And no one ever came into the classroom and said, I am a writer, and this is an option available to you. Or, I'm a writer, and I'm thoroughly enjoying the life that I'm leading, and you too can do this. And so as much as I can, to get people to recognize that it's one of the only things you can do where your voice is always legitimate. You know, and you always own your story. And at the bottom of that, you know, the undercurrent of that is, if you don't tell your own story or find a way to tell even snippets of your own story, you give permission for someone else to do it. And you never want to do that. So the problem with going into classrooms now is, the first one I went into years ago, and I said, hey, I'm here to teach you poetry. And what I had to do instead was spend a lot of time teaching or showing the kids that no matter how they said what they said, it was going to be listened to. Kind of have to back up, you know, kids are told, you're good at this, but you're not good at this. You're good at math, but you're not good at writing. And you have to spend a lot of time just kind of winding back the clock to say, when you open your mouth and sound comes out, or your pen touches paper and a word results, that word is important to me, you know. Part of your story. So it's a little disheartening to see how much of that has to be done, but there are more and more of us going into classrooms and doing that work.
Yeah, I think that's so important. That's a wonderful kind of activism, really, to help children recognize that they have this power and this ability to tell their own narrative. I mean, it is empowering. And yeah. I think, you know, I teach at a community college, and I know you teach at a college, and I have a lot of students who come through in my creative writing classes, and they are afraid to play and do the things that you were talking about, because English has been taught to them in a way that's rigid, and it's about rules, and things that are very natural and rhythmic and beautiful about their language are getting stifled.
Right.
And it's, yeah, I think to get them when they're younger.
A lot of them are learning toward whatever test they have to take,
mm-hmm.
you know, a test for the school or a yes. test to figure out where they stand among their peers or something. And they're so focused on the test that imagination just falls by the wayside. Mm. And some of them never recover from that.
Mm. And it is something to recover from, really, the way you stated it. Well, I know for me, like what you're saying about coming in and saying, I'm a writer, I'm a real person who is a writer, that would have been a really amazing thing for me, because I was much older when I realized that a woman could be a writer, that it didn't have to be this old, you know, ancient, dead for 300 years white male. So it kind of leads me to want to ask you, when was it that you realized that you could become a writer?
Well, my parents both came up from the South in the early 50s, part of the Great Migration. My mother came up from Alabama, my father from Arkansas. And my dad brought with him something that I like to call the tradition of the back porch.
Mm.
At the end of every day, he'd sit down and everything he did that day would become this serial narrative.
Oh, wow.
They both worked at a candy factory. You know, malted milk balls?
I do. I love those.
Right, yeah, those things you pop in your mouth. Well, my mom and dad both worked at that same place basically all of their working life. So, but my dad, at the end of the day, the people who he worked with kind of became characters, and he would say, you know, this guy's cheating on his wife, and this woman, that, you know. And so at the end, I would go, oh, what happened at work today? You know, and so what it did, it taught me that there was another way to use language besides what it was I was learning in school or not learning in school. And that the slate was blank every day. You know, the story was always new. It could change, and everything could change in the blink of an eye. So the idea of turning the life around you into stories came pretty early with my dad. And what you were saying about it being quite a bit of time before you found out that writers weren't all white dead men. When I first told, this is how the separation from my parents kind of began, because I told my mom and dad together, oh, I want to be a writer. And my dad said, oh, that's fantastic. I didn't even know what kind of writer. I just want to write. I love that words can do what they do. And my mom said, well, only white men do that. And not in, you know, I mean, to her, she turned on the television and there were all white men telling the news. When she would see something about someone having written a book or being interviewed or somebody, it was always a white man. So I think it was her way of kind of trying to steer me away from something that she felt would eventually just break my heart. Something that was never going to be. Yeah, wanting to be something that was never going to be attainable, but her whole focus was what I needed to do as an African-American child to assimilate. And assimilating did not include challenging, you know, white men at something that they felt was their domain. So, you know, she said, well, you could be a teacher or you could be a nurse. And only a certain kind of teacher. And it was like a teacher, not a professor, a nurse, doctor. Yeah. So, and you know, and I don't blame her for that, because that was kind of coming up from the South. That was like the height of success. You know, if you were able to get that kind of a job, the other job, which of course, up until I was 30 years old, she was still telling me that it was fantastic, was the post office. You know, they're hiring at the post office because it is a 9-to-5 benefits, retirement, vacation thing. And the idea of writing creatively for a living never really gelled with her.
And I'm sure she didn't mean that you could actually be the delivery, the person who carried the mail out. You just worked at the office, right?
No matter what they took, at the post office.
Right.
That was the job everybody wanted because it was so steady.
Well, and once that's a good thing.
Yeah. Once you were there, unless you really messed up, you were there for a long time.
Yeah, like tenure.
Yeah, tenure, right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it makes sense. It does. I mean, you know, her trying to protect you and wanting what's best for you, it does. I wanted to ask you also, I read your anthology, Staten Island Noir, and your story in there, When They Are Done With Us, is just, I mean, it's so powerful. It's just like a punch, you know? And, well, you're welcome. I was really blown away by it. And there were sections in there of poems that also were very beautiful and woven very well into the story. But the subject matter of the story, I mean, it's, you know, it's a child who is really, really a difficult child. And the mother's desperate, you know, way of wanting to deal with this. And I'm sort of wanting to get a little context on that. You know, how did that even come to you? It's such an amazing and unusual story.
Thanks. Well, Staten Island Noir, just briefly, the noir stories set in different places. And the book all the stories in the book have to be set in that place. They should be in a different area of that place. So there were different neighborhoods in Staten Island, and the writer should have some connection to Staten Island. I edited it. It was totally strange how they decided that a poet would edit this book.
So it shows you.
Well, I had gone to a crime fiction convention with my husband, and they had a panel on crime in New York, and they covered every borough except Staten Island. And I got so upset by that because, you know, when I talk to my students, they're saying, well, Staten Island is the bastard borough. Nobody pays attention to us. So at the end of this panel, I raised my hand and said, what about Staten Island? And I was very vocal about it. And there was a woman on the panel who had edited Brooklyn Noir and was talking to the publisher about, we haven't done Staten Island yet. And she said, well, there was this woman who was really upset about this, you know, and they knew me as a poet. They already knew me, so they had to kind of vet me and figure out, can we have a poet edit this anthology? And so I found the writers, and there's always space for you to do a story yourself. So I looked at some Staten Island news stories to see if there's something that I could, and I knew this one. I remembered this one. I remembered the fire. I remembered them thinking that the son had done it and the mother, and I was just fascinated by that. And I didn't want to make that family the focal point of the story, and so I put someone across the street from them, a woman who was also having difficulties with a child who was just kind of psychologically, you know, terrorizing her. And the way I get grounded in a genre that's unfamiliar to me is that's where the poetry came in. If I can work poetry into the somehow and think, because poetry is not only a recreational activity, it can be an escape for people. It could be a way they turn into themselves and the way they process something that's happening to them. So I thought, well, if she could be a poet, if she had moments where she escaped what was happening to her through poetry, I can kind of build the rest of the story up around it. I think I was surprised. My husband, the crime novelist, was surprised. And I think that the Akashic Press people were surprised that the story came out as dark as it did.
That's what I love about it, though.
Yeah, it was a bit much. And I mean, when I think about it, it's almost the same reason, for the same reason I write poetry. It's when you feel those kind of dark, poisonous things swirling about. It's so good to have that access to something that helps you get on the other side of them. You know, I don't really write poetry when I'm happy. I'm out, you know, when I'm out being happy. I go do something happy. There's not much, much hearts and flowers in my work, but it also keeps me sane. You know, so thinking that, you know, if I'd been in that woman's position and had poetry, yeah, I would turn to it, you know, when I could. That twist at the end, I had no idea that was coming. I just let it come and went, oh, okay then. And I also think every once in a while, oh, I want to write another story. I'd like to write more crime fiction. But I always feel like things are a one-shot deal when I do them outside of poetry, and I have to get my mind set up to approach it again. What I said about writing on deadline, or someone coming to me and saying, would you write this for us? Then it's okay. It's like that gives me the excuse. But to sit down and say, oh, I should be working on another crime fiction story, that's a little bit more difficult for me.
Well, hopefully someone watching this will come to you now and say, here's a story for you, or here's an anthology for you to do a story.
That'd be great. And it's due tomorrow or something.
Exactly. So, I thought it was fantastic, and I really did. I was in the twist ending that you're talking about. I mean, I just it totally fits, but it was such a surprise, a wonderful surprise. So I wanted to ask you also about a lot of things about your poetry, actually, but just sort of diving in. I think everybody who reads your poetry knows that you're a music lover. You've got the Motown Crown, and you've got the other book that's totally escaping my mind right now.
Oh, the Life According to Motown.
Thank you. So you've got those, and just all through your poems are just rhythmic and very, they make musical references. And so I just wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, the music in your life, you know, what you love, how it has sort of, impacted your writing and your life.
I think when I did Jimmy Savannah, I initially started thinking of it as a memoir in verse. That's how I was talking about it while I was writing. Mm-hmm. And it didn't start out that way. It started out, I wanted to do a whole book about Motown. Mm. Life According to Motown isn't really about Motown. It's got because at the time it was approaching or had just passed Motown's 50th anniversary, and I thought it would be great to do some poems about Motown artists, about the music, about how the music held sway over me when I was growing up. But then when I turned to that part of it, I realized that it wasn't a book about Motown. It was a book about being first generation up north. And the reasoning behind that is our parents were so confounded. You know, I mean, you get to this new part of the country, you know how to raise kids in the South, but you don't know how to raise kids in the city. You got this new environment, you've got new jobs, you need to have new rules for your kids, you don't know what they are. And I think that a lot of us turn to music for guidance. You know, so a lot of what my ideas about life and love and romance were pretty much defined by whatever Motown song was out at the time. I have such deep sentimental feeling for like Smokey Robinson and the Temptations.
Me too.
Yeah. I mean, anytime I can see him, I'm going to go see him. But it whizzes me right back to a time and a place and a mindset where all that unabashed romance was possible. You know, where you've gotten your heart broken for the first, second, or third time. And it was, at its simplest, it was an everything's going to be okay music, you know, that love's coming, heartbreak's coming, but you'll get through it, you know. And it is, for so many people my age or who grew up in those same circumstances, it is such a soundtrack for us. Not something I'll outgrow, not something I'll ever let go of. When I am given the choice of what music to listen to, that's what I listen to. It makes me a little bit sad when I see nowadays the music that, you know, teenagers are listening to that, I mean, it's fine in itself, but 20 years from now, what are they going to hear that takes them back to say, that's exactly who I was when I was a kid?
It's interesting, too, because to feel nostalgic about something that is so difficult. I mean, you're talking about music that says everything will be okay, but the music now says the world is hell and we're all going to die apocalypse is coming. And you know, it's very, very difficult. So it is kind of ironic in a way to think of people feeling nostalgic about that.
It was simple. It was singable. You know, the melodies were memorable. The songs told stories. Yeah. A lot of the songs, when you remember, they had beginnings, middles, and ends. You know, girl meets boy, girl breaks boy's heart, boy walks in front of train or something. you know, and it's strange because I listened to, you know, my husband's like, and it kind of just about a generation before me. And I listened to a lot of the 50s, were really heartbreak songs, you know, those kind of things. But they still somehow have that you want to go back and you want to hear them over and over again.
Yeah.
And I would love to have that same feel in my work where people recognize sentiments and rhythm in it and they want to come back to it long after they've read it for the first time.
Well, and I think you do. That's what really what I'm thinking in asking you this question is because when I was reading your work, I also became so nostalgic and I had actually a craving to hear the music and I made a soundtrack and I listened to it. And I feel it's the same. It's the same rhythms. And this is one of the things that I think you have a real gift for as a poet, because if you look at something like Blood Dazzler, it's a different feel, a different rhythm. But it's like what you're talking about, your subject matter is completely unified with the way that you're telling it. So like Blood Dazzler, for instance, it feels like a storm is just coming on you, coming after you. I mean, it is a very powerful, powerful set of poems, the collection. And there's also a cyclical. You've got you broke my heart with, is it Luther B?
Oh, you
broke my heart. That poor dog. So you've got Luther B, you've got the voodoo poems. They're revolving around like an eye, and then the storm. And it's just, I mean, you know, and then the music poems have the same feel. So I guess my question is this, like, do you actually set out and say, I'm going to make the content and the form match, or is it the inspiration that pushes you there?
The thing about Blood Dazzler is there's an eye in the storm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as if I wanted that eye to see everything.
Mm.
Not just what it had touched, but also the dog that was left. And, you know, a while ago in my MFA program, I decided that I wanted to learn about the muscle and bone of what I was doing. I got introduced to poetry by getting up on stage and doing it. Right. But once you have it down on a page and you know that the person who's reading it can't hear and see you, you have to learn what you can do technically to put your voice in that person's head.
Yes.
And so if I want you to feel breathless and frenetic, I have to know how to put the words on the page and what kind of words to use and what order to use them in and what poem comes after what poem so that you don't realize that you haven't taken a breath until you finish the book, you know. And Katrina, kind of by starting, I guess what helped me was starting chronologically while she was still a tropical depression and having it be a building storm. And feeling as I was writing the same kind of change that you feel in the air when a storm is coming. And if I can feel that, then I can pull my writing to that place so that I'm reading my work aloud while I'm writing and I still have to feel that foreboding, you know, that, okay, I've left this. at the end of this poem, I've left the reader on the edge of something. So yeah. Let's pick up that and take them further out on the edge as opposed to tying things up in a neat little knot. So I think that there are things that you can do technically to help heighten a reader's response to the poem. Right. So, and some of that comes from what I learned in spoken word, because you can look at an audience and you can get a reaction right away. Is this working or is it not working? But it's a little frustrating sometimes to know exactly how you want a series of poems to sound, how you want your reader to hear them, and to not be able to do that. So I think that what I've studied lately is the effect of the poem on the page, on the reader, whether I can, you're in control when you open the book. Right. So whether or not I can take your breath away with a poem is totally dependent upon me and how I craft that poem. Right. So, you know, if it needs to be jazzy and I want to make a poem feel like a piece of music, then I have to have that music in my head when I write.
Yeah.
I have to be able to read it and have you hear. You know, it's kind of like a tunnel of energy back and forth between reader and poet. But yeah, I don't sit and say, well, Blood Dazzler's got to feel this way. That book right. took a weird turn anyway. It wasn't a book in my head until much later, and I had finished a lot of the poems in it, but you're driven to the page because you feel a certain way.
Right.
So if you hear that, you know, 34 nursing home residents have died, and you feel that desolation and that quiet, and the lights are out and the water's rising and you hear people calling, but they're not being answered, then that's a certain feel in your belly, you know, and you want to put that feeling on page. That's what you said. And when you're done, if you're not feeling it, then something else needs to be done.
Yeah.
The one thing, I just read this, I was just in Providence doing a reading, and I hadn't done anything from this book in a while, and I think some professors had been talking about it in their class. So, you know, I was telling them that when you're putting a book together, you usually will balance the long poems, the short poems, the funny poems, the sad poems, and you're writing about something like Katrina and there aren't any funny moments, you know, and so you kind of have to find something that lets a little bit of light in, which is where the poems with all the hurricanes, the siblings poem comes in.
Right.
Oh, okay, well, I can do, you know, if she's personified in the book, then she has a family.
Yeah.
You know, so I found that little moment and I said, okay, because to just pound the reader over the head constantly, you've really got to give them some breath somewhere.
Right, yeah, exactly. So. And I hadn't really thought about it that way, but that's really a neat thought about, you know, if she's personified, she has siblings. So in come the other hurricanes, it makes sense. Yeah, so it sounds like, I mean, almost it reminds me of like learning a sport. Like, you know, let's say you're learning to play baseball or something and you learn where to put your feet and your hands and everything. But then when you go to hit the ball, you're not thinking about those things, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's a sure way to just freeze.
Yeah.
You really, at some point, you just kind of have to give it over.
Yeah.
Yeah, and trust in it. It was a strange transition from just having everything pour out on stage because I was able to make adjustments and tell the audience, oh no, I didn't mean that.
Right.
Instead, and you can't do that on the page. So it's so hard to let something go.
Oh yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. The book I just finished, they would say, okay, you've got a couple of more days. And I go in and I change a bunch of poems. And if they said you've got 10 minutes, I'd be saying, oh, this is not good enough. I have to do, you know.
Oh, right.
Yeah. At some point, you really have to say it's as good as it's going to get. And it has the effect that I started out to try to achieve. So let's just let it go.
It's amazing to me that you're so prolific and such a perfectionist at the same time. That's not a usual combination.
I guess not. But you know, a lot of the things you see are poems that I've had for a while, and then I've gone out and I've done readings, and tweaked a little after each reading. That felt good. That didn't. And I think they may build up a little bit faster than most writers simply because I do so much traveling and reading.
Right.
And the more of that I do, the more inspired I am to keep writing. Or maybe I'll hear some students read, and that'll give me an idea for something. I listen to a lot of other poets read that I read along with on programs, and they give me ideas. So the writing is constantly, you know, in, at some stage or another. So by the time it's time for a book to come out, there's a lot of poems that people haven't seen.
That's wonderful. So you get a lot of inspiration from other writers then.
Definitely. And it's maddening. It really is. Because you know, every time you walk out of the door, if you learn how to look at the world the way a poet looks at the world, you will lose your mind. Because inspiration just smacks you in the face wherever you are. And it's not, oh, it doesn't have to be poetic inspiration. Right. When something comes back to your head more than three times, it's begging to be written about.
Wow, I like that.
And it might be something dark. It might be something happy. It might be a snippet of conversation you heard. The snippet of conversation doesn't have to be a poem. It could be a scene in a short story. It can lead to a character. You know, when you start to see how those synapses fire, that nothing comes to your attention for no reason at all. You know, you rethink something and you go, wow, the person who said that looks intriguing and may make a good, you know, might be a good description for a character. The way they said it, the accent that they had, the words they chose, you know, it's not just something that you see, it's what you hear, it's what you hear someone else thinks, you know. So you keep a little notebook, you write all this little stuff down, and eventually something that you're not sure was ever going to go anywhere, something else will attach itself to it, like another line and you go, okay, so now it's on its way.
Yeah.
And you kind of nurture it. You put it's like sitting on an egg. You know, it's like, yes, come to me.
Right. I'll do a, you know, magical spell on you. me. Well, I would love to hear you read something. Do you have anything you'd like to share?
I think I will read something from Jimmy Savannah.
Wonderful.
Yay.
And it's here, too.
Yeah. So I think I'll do the title poem.
Great.
Because, and this is one of the things I have to get out of from spoken word. I used to always over-introduce my stuff, and I'd say, and this is called this for this reason, and then it's all in the poem. And I feel like anyway, so.
Well, I'm all ears. Anything you want to say?
Well, the book got its title because this is what my father wanted to name me. To name me Jimmy Savannah, which I think would have been the most glorious poet name ever. My mother wasn't having it, so. My mother scraped the name Patricia Ann from the ruins of her discarded Delta, thinking it would offer me shield and shelter that leering men would skulk away at the snap of it. Her hands on the hips of Alabama, she went for flat and functional, then siphoned each syllable of drama, repeatedly crushing it with her broad, practical tongue until it sounded like an instruction to God and not a name. She wanted a child of pressed head and knocking knees, a trip up in the double dutch swing, a starched pinafore and peppermint in the sour pickle kind of child, stiff-laced, and unshakably fixed on salvation. Her, Patricia Ann, would never idly throat the Lord's name or wear one of those thin, sparkled skirts that flirted with her knees. She'd be a nurse or a third-grade teacher or a postal drone, jobs requiring alarm clock discipline and sensible shoes. My four downbeats were music enough for a vapid life of butcher shop sawdust and fat back as cuisine, for raid spritzed into the writhing pockets of a Murphy bed. No crinkled consonants or muted hiss would summon me. My daddy detested borders. one look at my mother's watery belly, and he insisted, as much as he could insist with her, on the name Jimmy Savannah, seeking to bless me with the blues-bathed moniker of a ball breaker, the name of a grown gal in a snug red dress and unlaced all-star. He wanted to shoot muscle through whatever I was called, arm each syllable with tiny weapons, so no one would mistake me for anything other than a tricky whisperer with a switchblade in my shoe. I was bound to be all legs, a bladed debutante hooked on lucky strikes and sugar. When I sent up prayers, God's boy would giggle and consider. Daddy didn't want me to be anybody's surefire factory, nobody's callback or seized rhythm, so he conjured a name so odd and hot even a boy could claim it. And yes, he was prepared for the look my mother gave him when he first mouthed his choice. The look that said, "That's it. You done lost your goddamn mind." She did that thing she does where she grows 2 full inches with righteous. And he decided to just whisper, "Love you, Jimmy Savannah," whenever we were alone, re and rechristening me the seed of Otis, conjuring his own religion and naming it me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
That is the coolest dad ever.
That, I mean, that poem has it all. It has, you know, beauty and excitement and fun and everything.
Thank you for sharing that.
I think you are Jimmy Savannah.
Thanks. I have a cool, like, baseball jersey that I got that there's a school in Chicago, Gwendolyn Brooks Middle School. And so the front of the shirt says Gwendolyn Brooks Warriors, and the back has a number and Savannah on it.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, you know, it kind of reminds me of one of the things that you said. I think it was in another interview somewhere I read that you said that I think it was slam poetry teaches you to live your life out loud.
Yeah.
And this poem is very, you know, it's so open and expressive. I wondered if you could say a little more about that, because I think that's such a powerful statement to make.
Well, the time that I came up doing that was like at the very, the very beginning of spoken word, but just when it was becoming sort of another arm of these vibrant literary communities where you could go someplace and read in an open mic. And, you know, and I found out that in Chicago there were all these places where this was going on that I didn't know anything about. And I think if you say you're impassioned about writing, you should want to write in as many ways as possible and get it across in as many ways as possible. So in the early days, we really didn't have an idea of what sort of poetry should we be, you know. So it was much more like a conversation with the audience. And it was so valuable because we didn't feel like we were alone. People brought what was happening in their lives to the stage. You know, whether it be something that they were having a hard time getting past or a loss that they had, you know, and I guess what you feel is that as I felt that way too. I just didn't know there was a way to express it. And so it was like all these hands kind of reaching out and grabbing other hands and saying, we now have this forum, we have this place. And for that reason, I am closer to people that I met at that time in my life than I am to some members of my family, because they know so much more about me at such a depth, you know, where you're really kind of digging and saying, I want this writing not to just be, you're not really just trying to entertain people, although there was a lot of that, but you're also being very human out loud, and you want people, to hear that, go home and see that they have a way of getting their stories across, that maybe they don't bring it to an audience right away, but they can write it and they can put it out and read it when they need to read it and say, here's what I was thinking a month or a year or 2 years ago. Here's where I was as a human being. I've either regressed or I've gotten better since then. So let's see what I need to do to reach that point. You know, and so I can't underestimate. I mean, we started out talking about the value for kids, but the value for just people, you know, maybe who never even pick up a pen, but who just go and hear other people talk out their lives. The idea that you're not going through whatever it is alone is right there for you to grasp. You know, so it's so valuable. And I just, you know, people ask me about the slam a lot, and there's two things that are happening there. One is it's fun. It's a poetry competition. You can't really take that, the competition itself, so seriously. You know, we pick judges who just wandered in off the street into a bar. You know, it's like, well. So, but it was like a big fish hook that went out that pulled a lot of people in who normally wouldn't have been in a poetry audience. And, you know, for me, it wound up being the way I wanted to live my life. So you can't underestimate the importance of it.
Well, I think that's an incredibly powerful thing. I think so many people are really afraid of their own voice and their own story. You know, it makes me think, I don't know if you've noticed this, you probably have because you're the one who did it, but in your poetry, I noticed just over the years, every collection that I read had throat imagery. It was the most predominant image that I noticed. And I thought, this is so interesting because it makes sense that that would be a predominant image for a poet, but it feels deeper than that for you, you know?
Yes.
I think it relates to what we're talking about.
Well, there's two things I can think about right away. Is one that, and I mentioned my mother briefly, but my mother was a little ashamed of coming from the South. Mm. So that whole segment of what should be my lineage, she kind of cut off, like, oh, what do you want to know about that for? So I've spent a lot of my writing life looking for my own history, mm-hmm. in a way. And so it's important not to have that shut off or closed off. And also I kind of think of poetry as a second throat. Yeah. You know, we spend our lives with all these restrictions. You can talk about these things in certain places, but only to certain people and only in certain ways. But what I said earlier about students, it's the only place where you start out totally free. And unless you screw that up, you remain totally free for the life of your writing, you know, your poetry career. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that second throat is alive and the flow is constant. Yeah.
That's wonderful. I'm thinking about opening the throat. I'm thinking about in your poetry, you wrote about so many things that I was just reading and saying, you can write a poem about that. You can write a poem about that. And just all the different places that you got inspiration, a news story, a flyer that you saw on the wall, something that happened at a gas station. And it's all like this fodder for this great poetry. And it also relates to what you're saying about living out loud and speaking, speaking your narrative, your own narrative, instead of letting someone else claim it. And I wonder if you have any advice for someone who might be afraid to sort of claim their narrative or to write or to tell their story for, I mean, it could be any reason, you know, maybe they're afraid of their family seeing it or they're nervous about their talent. Like, what would you advise for that?
Yeah, I hear a lot of that. I think the idea that we have to get away from is that the ultimate goal is to speak it out loud to a room full of strangers. You know? I think the ultimate goal is for you to get it down so that you see it. Okay? And you might think of that as a first step, you know, or something, but some people never get beyond that, you know. When you're afraid of parts of your story, you're afraid to even write them down. You're afraid to journal them. You're afraid you don't, you know, it's like if it exists on paper, it becomes this other thing. And I think we skip that step. We think, how could I possibly say this to people? Or what if this gets out and my family sees it? I think we just really need to tell our stories to ourselves. And I'm amazed at the power of simply sitting in a room and asserting something and saying it out loud, you know, whether it be, I am not, my mother and I are not friends, you know, or my son is in jail, or, you know, to say it, to write out how it makes you feel, to write out instances that, you know, discussions you've had with the people, whatever, to write out why it makes you feel bad, how you think your friend, you know, and to have that story, whether or not, and after a while, when you begin to realize that that story is not your story alone, maybe you reach a point where you say, I think this will help someone if I say it out loud, but not to feel as if you failed if you don't ever reach that point. We run from our own story so much. It's like we pave things over and we think, thank God that's not, I never have to look at that again. But if you turn around, the pavement's like, you know, buckling, like, yeah, you know, you now have the ability to pull that story out, look at it, change it, analyze it, realize how much of it is you, how it made you the person that you are. All that stuff can be done in solitude. You know, it can be done in solitude. And once you're on the other side of that story or you've come to terms with it somehow, you have succeeded and you don't ever have to say another word of it to anyone else.
Wow. Yeah. That's an amazing thing. Thank you. Well, one other thing embedded in that question, you are so innovative as well. You really invented your own forms in a lot of the poems. And, of course, you apparently have a lot of knowledge of form. You used, you know, you had the sonnet crayon. You had the poems that were in the Tonka. Series of Tonka. Lots of different forms. But then I was also just really, you know, impressed by the forms that you created yourself. There were some that would have like lines from somewhere in the media and then the poem and the way it alternated and the way it was visually on the page. I guess I'm just asking if you have any advice on how people can sort of stay free. I mean, maybe it goes back to what you were saying earlier about keeping the play in it, but you seem to be freer than most people in terms of, well, really, I mean, in your writing, you're open and you're free, and it creates new things, not just new poems, but new kinds of poems. So is there any advice that you would give on that or anything?
I think there was a pathway because starting out in spoken word and then just starting to write, I was totally undisciplined. You know, I would, if you looked at a poem that I'd written, it was just all across the page. I hadn't given any thought to line breaks or anything like that. I would just break when either I reached the edge of the page or I usually breathe here, so I should break this, you know.
Yeah.
And the path I needed to follow was I need to know what the structure can do. So I wanted to sort of rein myself in. So I said, okay, let's study prosody. The key is to still have all that feeling and all that spontaneity in the poem, but be able to bring it under a structure. So there's a tension that's developed, like how did you still, you know, and not let the structure drive the poem, which is always an issue, especially when people first start learning it. It's like, oh my God, I don't want to use that word, but I have to because no other word will work in that line at this meeting ever, you know. And so it's constantly been kind of like that back and forth. But I felt it was really important for me to learn the structure as much as I could because then I feel so exhilarated when I'm able to break it and you know what structure I'm breaking.
Right.
You see? Or to sort of introduce a rhythm to you that's going to start to feel familiar but then suddenly isn't. Mm-hmm. Is my thing is if and this is not only with rhythm and structure, but it's in your choice for what you choose to write about, your syntax, everything, is that eventually I want to be able to put a poem that I've written on a table in a room and have someone pick it up and say, oh, Patricia, you must have dropped this poem. My name's not on it.
Yes. And
you know, I kind of want, I tell that to my students that we should all kind of be in pursuit of signature. Yes. And that goes a long way. You know, like I can hear a poem. I've got some poets now, Ocean and Inez and, you know, and these wonderful, wonderful Saeed Jones. And, you know, I hear something and I see it, and the next three poems I write sound exactly like them.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's what needs to happen. But then eventually you take what you've learned from them, you fold it into your own signature, and you keep going. Oh. So it's not, you know, people think, oh my God, I don't want to turn into that poet. Right. But you don't really. It's like musical signatures or anything. They've established theirs. You can envy it. You can throw up everything and go, oh my God, I might as well be selling real estate. That poem, yeah, that poem is so good, but it reached you for a reason, and you're going to internalize why it reached you, and next time you write, you're going to say, okay, I need to have that effect on people.
Yeah.
So the whole thing with the structure and the forms and breaking the forms, it's okay to break the form, but I need to keep breaking it in a way that conjures my signature. Like, that sonnet is weird, and it's weird in a Patricia way.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, you know, you constantly kind of have signature in mind. And it involves learning the tough way to do it before you can get back to feel free about it. You kind of need to learn it by the books first. And then when you can just crack that a little bit and say, okay, we're not going to go that way with this line. We're going to go this way. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that anybody else would do.
Yeah.
And so you build that up as much as you can. So with each book, although it's not something I'm consciously thinking about, when I finish the book, I can look at it and say, look, they're right there. It's right there. No, because after a while, it's like unconscious. It's because I talk the lines out so much, and I say, okay, well, it's, you know, I seem to be falling into a pattern, so let's talk the next line out in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I usually will like how it comes out. But I think all writers have some version of that they do, especially when they've been writing for a while.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I'm starting to realize that we're running out of time. It feels like I've only been talking to you for like 10 minutes, but it's been like an hour.
So I apologize for running away from you.
No, it was great.
It's that woman who wants me to do Skype. Oh my God. Anyway,
know. I thought you sent me something that said, I think you said you'd rather swallow broken glass than do Skype. And I thought, oh no.
But you know what's weird about it is I'm not looking. You're looking at me. I'm not looking at me. I'm looking at you.
Right.
So you're the big picture. I'm the little picture.
Right.
So look at you, and it's like we're kind of sitting across the room from each other. So it's not bad at all.
That's right. It feels like we're just chatting.
Tell the Skype people that I'm back on board. It's okay.
Oh, everybody will be so happy. Wonderful. Well, in closing, I do want to ask you what's next for you, both like what's coming out next and also what are you working on?
What is coming out next? I have a book coming out in February 2017. It was originally going to come out this fall, but because I held on to it tweaking poems for so long, it was going to come out at the end of the cycle, and it was kind of like, and this, you know. So we thought it would be really nice if it could come out around the D.C., AWP, and so I feel really good about that. I don't feel so rushed with it. So it is called Incendiary Art, and it'll be out in February 2017. I am working on my husband and I collect photographs, 19th century photographs of African Americans, daguerreotypes and cabinet cards and tintypes, things like that. And so I'm working on a book that mixes dramatic monologues with some of the photos, kind of like taking a group of the photos and setting up kind of an Our Town type thing and having the dialogues and having them talk to each other within the book. That one's a little bit more involved. So I think that's the next thing on the list. And my husband, Bruce De Silva, and I are thinking about writing a crime novel together. In alternating voices.
Wow.
He has a very clipped, you know, that clipped crime novel, just the facts, ma'am thing, and tend to be overly descriptive and lush and all that. And so I'm going to take the woman's viewpoint. He's going to take a Chicago policeman in 1968, and I'm going to be an African-American woman in a beauty salon. And we're going to do alternating voices, and it's set at the right before and after the riots following the King assassination.
Wow.
So we're kind of trying to testing ourselves, making sure we get along well enough to write a book together.
Oh my God. That's we've one of the funniest things I've ever heard, because that's more difficult than marriage, right?
Oh, yeah. We've been warned against it by several couples. I've tried and failed. I think the key is being in two different genres, too.
Right.
Because he helps me a lot with my poems. He's an former newspaper reporter and editor, and he's a great editor, and I help him add flourish to his clipped prose, and he helps me clip and go overboard. So we work really well together so far, so we shall see.
So it's a marriage made in the pen.
It is. It says, yeah, we talk all the time. We're constantly recommending writers to each other. I've introduced him to poetry, which was not someplace he ever thought he would be delving. I love crime fiction now, so it's working out real well.
Wonderful. Well, it was such a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
I appreciate you taking the leap into Skype with me.
Oh, that's okay. It's a whole, you know, I think too, when I first did it at early days of Skype, it was a lot different. It's like your image is actually big enough for me to actually imagine you sitting across right in the chair, right across. So it was fun. I could focus. You have great eyes and great smile. It was easy to you're easy to focus on, Melissa.
Oh, I feel shy now. Thank you. You too. I can completely see this huge image of you, and it's your face, and I just feel like you're right there talking to me. So
that's great. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and I'm looking forward to your new work.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Okay. I appreciate that.
Okay. Night.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.